Good afternoon and welcome to Sunday at Noon. I'm your host, Susan McInnes. In 1911, a 9-year-old girl set off with her mother from the big city of Seattle to travel by steamer and train to meet her stepfather in a town far away called Fairbanks. It was in the wilds of Alaska, and there she began an adventurous life in the new frontier. This 9-year-old is today Margaret Murray. She was the first woman graduate of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines, later the wife and longtime partner to Olaus Murray, renowned biological scientist with whom she traveled and studied Alaska's wilderness. Together, they were instrumental in establishing national parks and setting aside wilderness areas in what would become the state of Alaska. Margaret Murray, it's a pleasure to have you join me on Sunday at Noon today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some of us, I have, lived 50 miles from nowhere in this state of Alaska, and there are many people, even with the sound of our voices today, who still live 50 miles from nowhere, on the rivers and in the hills, and
oh, yes,
catch us by fluke. But I think there are so many people who have come from the states of the Union to Alaska and have never left Fairbanks, have never known the land outside it and the wilderness it once was. So I'm hoping we can spend the next hour looking at the wilderness from 1911 on, as you met it when you were a 9-year-old girl coming from Seattle. You left on the steamer Jefferson in 1911. What was that like from Seattle?
Oh, it was a lovely steamer, and the captain was a man named Gus Nord, I believe, and I thought it was just like a palace, and there was a certain routine established, apparently, by custom. The dinner at night served was like a banquet, and everybody changed to some nicer clothes for dinner, and I remember changing into my white China silk dress with a lacy bertha on it, and my best shoes that were straps, patent leather, and strapped up over my ankle, and that was dinner at night. And during the day, the ladies sat in the lounge and doing their knitting or crocheting and talking. And the children were free to run around and play all sorts of games. And it was just a lovely interval as far as all the children were concerned. And there were 4 or 5 of us on that trip that I remember. When I was starting to write my recollections of those as part of my book, Two in the Far North, I sent the manuscript to my mother, who was still living in Seattle, for suggestions. And she sent it back, and all she said was, "How did you remember all that?"
But you say,
I think that a 9-year-old child, and I've noticed it in other children and in my own grandchildren, that a 9 to 11-year-old child is very observant. There is very little that gets by them without it being registered in their minds, I think.
It certainly did you. This is a vivid introduction.
And I still remember every item of that trip from Seattle to Skagway and over the White Pass and Yukon Railroad and the other steamer and the other steamer and 4 different steamers before we got to Fairbanks.
Well, and you came into Dawson in midway on that trip. But Dawson must have been a booming city in 1911.
Yes, it was. It was a very busy place, and when any sternwheel steamer came into the dock, the whole populace, it seemed, was down there on the dock to greet people and look for friends, and it was all a moving, busy, buzzing kind of a settlement. And the steamer we transferred to, at that point, that from Dawson down to St. Michael, the great big Mississippi River packet ships. Big sternwheel ships with 2 stacks and a great, beautiful siren sort of whistle when they blew. And there was the Hannah and the Sarah and the, what was the other one? Louise. There were 4 of them that ran from Dawson to Michael and back up again.
And you wrote there was and one named Herman that was pretty...
Yes, that was a little smaller.
Right.
Yes, it was not quite as palatial as the others.
The ladies of the line you described as being the queens of the river. Yes.
Yes, they were. Yes.
Beautiful. When you first came into Dawson, there's a passage from your book that says, I think my gentle mother began to learn about the North Country that night. All was costly. Everything was done on a lavish scale. Life was exciting and each day a story in itself, and nothing was worth worrying about.
Well, that's the way it was, I think. But I think everybody, as soon as they arrived in that part of the world, discovered that this was whatever they were embarked upon was likely to be a big adventure, and they needed to sort of key themselves up to that point of being ready to accept new things and unusual things and new ways of life. And I'm sure it was that way for my mother.
And part of this was because of the mining environment, because everything could be won or lost in moments. The whole fortunes could go away.
That's true, yes. It was all a big gamble. But mining was the thing. It was the, as I said in another class this morning, it was the god. And that idea has continued throughout the years, I think, that mining takes precedence over a lot of other things. And as I think back on the early days in Fairbanks, I sort of visualize this little tiny, in comparison to the size of the interior Alaska, this little town right in the center of Alaska buzzing away busily, and the whole great wilderness all around it for thousands of hundreds of miles. That's my sort of childhood feeling about the place.
Very, very different than it is today. When I read your description, I was struck. I live right in the middle of town in Fairbanks, on Fifth Avenue, not far from where you live.
Yes, right.
But in 1911, the little house your dad found was at the very edge.
That was the edge. That was the last street in Fairbanks, the last street that was named Bonnefield.
And it was the 8th Street away from the river?
8th Street away from the river.
On Bonnefield. And people will know that today if they'll close their eyes and think of 8th and Bonnefield now.
It was a four-room log cabin.
Which, that's fairly sizable, four rooms.
Well, yeah, there was a living and dining room was one room, and then there was a bedroom and a kitchen, and then a lean-to sort of thing that wasn't log, but that was another bedroom.
And
that was my bedroom.
Your room.
Yes.
Can you describe the walk to the river?
I used to walk from our house and in free times just through a little birch grove, and then there was a little slough that sometimes had water and it sometimes didn't, and then there was, beyond that was the river you could follow, and that would take you down about near what used to be the slaughterhouse, and it was also the dog pound where dogs were kept.
There were dogs.
I remember that, dogs everywhere. Yes, but they were very strictly controlled. You get into real trouble if you had a dog and let it loose in the town of Fairbanks, because that was too dangerous. And there was a humane officer who would immediately come and take the dog if the dog bit anybody, and that you wouldn't see the dog again. I've often wondered, living in Wyoming, where things seem to be quite free and easy and people don't think much about controlling their dogs, and I remember those days in Fairbanks when you had to be very careful. Dogs had to be kept chained all the time. Hmm. Yes, that was one of the features.
The river itself was ran along Front Street.
Where yes.
There were a few warehouses and then saloons.
Saloons. I think about 23 saloons.
For a town of how many people?
Sounds ridiculous now, doesn't it?
Yeah. How big was Fairbanks?
I hope I'm not wrong about that, but somebody... That was over a distance of about 7 blocks, you see, all along the front of the town. And then there was the dock where the sternwheel steamers came in. And then there was the Northern Commercial Company. They had the big store, and on the block behind them, on second, was the power plant that furnished the power and the steam heat. They even had steam heat in the buildings that are right there in the center of Fairbanks that were provided by the NC Company boiler house power plant.
Northern Commercial.
They dug trenches and laid pipes and took steam heat into the buildings like the courthouse and the bank, and I suppose Lavery and Bailey's grocery store, and what was on the other corner, somebody's insurance company.
That's all. It.
And that was the
Second
courthouse.
And Cushman?
Second and Cushman,
right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Northern Commercial was the center for many things.
Oh, yes.
Then, wasn't it?
Yes.
They...
Clothing, groceries, hardware, everything.
But they also had the sleigh lines running up and down the Valdez Trail. Am I right about that or no?
Well, the stage line was, I guess, partly owned by the NC Company, but there was also a stage company called by somebody whose last name was Orr, O-R-R, and I can't remember what his first name was, but he also ran a stage line to Valdez. But I think when I went out over the trail, my first adventure, when I was 15 and a half, mm-hmm. That was the Northern Commercial Company stage line that I was on, I'm sure.
On their line.
Uh-huh. This wonderful stage driver named Roy Reinierson. That was the first one I was with.
Living in Fairbanks at that time, very different than it is now, unless one is outside of town without what we think of as the necessities, which are amenities of life.
Yes, as soon as you get to the town, I imagine that you have all modern conveniences.
Potentially,
I'm housed in here on the campus right now on my visit to the university in one of the newer student houses, and it's a very palatial apartment. There's even a microwave in the kitchen, which I don't dare touch because I've never had a microwave and wouldn't know what to do with it. I'm more and more impressed with how ultra-modern everything is here on the campus now.
Very
compared
different.
To, yes. Well, I think the women, you sometimes wonder, and I guess I said in my book, what kind of a civilization would the men have made if they had come just then looking for gold and no women? It was the proper women of the town who set the pattern of what life like in Fairbanks should be. And I think they were quite, maybe they didn't think about it a lot, but they just automatically, I suppose, fell into the same pattern that they had used outside where some of them had come from. But there was a certain pattern for every day. And having a certain occupation for every day, I think, helped a great deal in their dealing with the cold weather and in the winter and the difficulties of housekeeping and in the summer by the mosquitoes. But there was Monday was wash day and Tuesday was ironing day and Wednesday was go to ladies' aid meeting day and Thursday afternoon they went out to call on some friends and leave their cards and Saturday was baking day. Mm-hmm. And I remember making cookies when I was 9 years old. That was my first adventure. Mm-hmm. Make a whole batch of molasses cookies on Saturday morning, and that was it. We baked bread and baked cake, and then most houses had what they called a cache, like we might call a woodshed, back of the kitchen, and there was a cabinet, cupboard of some kind, where you could just put things and they just froze, and you didn't have to worry about anything. I suppose people nowadays have freezers that run on electricity, but in those days the universe ran it for us.
Right. And also the mighty axe.
Yes.
to keep your houses warm.
Oh, yes.
Certainly wash day was,
yes,
not putting things in a machine. You boiled
water. No, you boiled the water, you put the wash boiler on the stove and stoked up the wood stove with wood. And told the children, if there were some, to get in the living room by the stove in there so they wouldn't get chilled while all that water was being carried in. Then put the blue card in the window so Fred the water man would carry water in. The most of the wells in Fairbanks were so mineralized, mm-hmm, and so full of lime that it was very difficult to use. It was such hard water. But there were, I think, just two good wells in the town, and each of those, the people who owned those were in business, and big tank wagons in the summer and tank sleighs in the winter drawn by great big gray horses.
Fred the waterman was
Fred
yours.
The waterman would come in with a yoke over his shoulders and a 5-gallon gasoline can, or whatever, that's what they used, in each hand hanging from the yoke, and fill the barrel. A water barrel stood in a corner of the kitchen, and I think it was a whiskey barrel. I'm not sure, but there were certain things that came in barrels in those days, mm-hmm, and Every household had a couple of barrels, one that they caught rainwater in the summertime, because that was very important to get that soft water. You had to use that for your shampoos and for special washings. Every little thing had to be taken account of to make a part of the living pattern.
You write that when you hunted blueberries in the summertime, you would bring them home and put them in wood boxes and sink them into the rain barrel so that
they
would
cranberries.
Freeze. Cranberries, so it was towards fall.
Yes, towards fall. When the first frost had nipped them, that's when they turned sweet, were very good, and they were still. And you would pick them in and put them in these shallow boxes and put them down what was the rain barrel during the summer, and had to be emptied in the fall, of course, because it would freeze and expand. But the cranberries were there all winter. You just went out and they froze, and they were just like little marbles. They didn't stick together or anything, and it was very easy to bring them in. My mother made a wonderful kind of pie, which was cranberries and raisins, and you put them through the meat grinder before they thaw, and that's very, very easy.
Very tasty.
Yes, and she made a pie filling with those. And we also make cranberry jelly, certainly. Now, the blueberries were put up in barrels that were put out in some friend who had a mine out on the creeks, and we put it down in a cold shaft until freeze up, and then you could bring it to town and put it down in your cellar. Every house had a cellar where the vegetables were kept. And the blueberries, you'd put a layer of sugar and a layer of blueberries and so on up to the top. And I don't know why, but they didn't ferment. You could go down in the wintertime and take up a scoop of blueberries and cook them, do whatever you wanted with them.
They didn't freeze fully, and they didn't...
No, they didn't freeze because they were kept in the cellar.
The sugar must have kept them fine and the coolness, I guess.
Yes, huh? Kept them from fermenting.
Lots of tricks.
I don't know who invented all these things, but...
But wonderful tricks to be able to provide things that were
certainly
tasty and celebratory.
And because the Creator hadn't seen fit to have fruit trees growing in Alaska, we had berries. Black currants and red currants and cranberries and high bush cranberries and blueberries and dewberries. Yes.
Made for great summers, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Summer was a berry picking month, very busy.
Right. Can you tell us about winter in Fairbanks in the early 1900s, in the teens?
It was cold. I remember one winter when we had about 50 below for about 3 weeks, and that was just more than anybody had ever heard of, and just about wore us out. I mean, people were really troubled by that. And my stepfather was being very careful of me, and he wouldn't let me go to school if it was more than 50 below, but they never closed the schools on account of temperature. And so I didn't like that restriction because I was then considered to be a sissy, you see, because I didn't come to school when it was 50 below. I had to walk at least a half a mile to school. I mean, it was from 8th and Bonnefield to 8th and Cushman. That was the distance. And I remember those winter mornings. I'd be walking to school, and the sun would be just coming up. There'd just be an orange glow in the sky ahead of me as I walked to school.
Just enough of light to get you there.
Yes. And the lights would be on in the school building until, 10 o'clock at least. And they'd have to turn them on again about 2 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came out from school at 3:30, it was full dark. Well, it still does that, I'm sure. I don't think that's changed.
No, modern times, we can't change that.
No.
And this was Fairbanks School?
Yes, I was at Fairbanks Public School. Yeah, it was the only school. It was the only building. The grade school was downstairs, and the high school was upstairs. And there was a little belfry on top of the building.
That rang the bell to tell you to come?
They rang the boys used to climb up there and ring the bell on Halloween night, I know. There was the janitor was named Mr. Gertz, and he came out on the porch and rang his hand bell when it was 9 o'clock, when we were all supposed to be in the building. But if he saw you rushing, coming, trying to get there, because we were penalized if we were late, he might keep his bell ringing a little few extra rings until you got in the door, and then you'd be all right.
You could be in your seat in time, and nobody'd
yes.
yell at you.
All right.
Very good. You weren't supposed to go up to Front Street. I'm looking at my notes because of the saloons. But something about 2nd and 3rd Streets.
Well, 2nd Avenue was the NC Company power plant, and I was afraid of that because I was absolutely, still am, allergic to loud sounds. And I was afraid the fire whistle, the siren, would blow just when I was going by. And 3rd Avenue was the town hall and the fire hall, and I was sure that just as I was going by, those big gray horses would come galloping out from... It was horsepower in those days, you
sure,
know.
Sure, to get to everything.
Well, 4th Avenue was the row, the red light district, with big boarded up at each end on the street, so you couldn't go through.
You couldn't go through it.
No. So I would go down to 5th and go across to Cushman on 5th and then go down Cushman to where the stores were when I was doing errands for my mother. And usually I was traveling with my dog, Major. That was one of the first things that happened to me when we arrived. A friend of my stepfather's had raised this dog and trained him very beautifully, and he gave him to me. Mm-hmm. And I had a little coaster sled, and Major and I on weekends. And the other kids had, likewise, lots of them. And we'd all be out running all over town with our little dogs and little sleds on Saturday. Maybe running errands for our mothers, or maybe just running around. And then there was a skating rink right below the bridge. And there were, right at that point, there were a couple of institutions called cigar stores where the miners from the creeks who were spending the winter in town, you know, couldn't maybe mine in the wintertime. And they'd be sitting there, and they would sort of watch that. And some of them would come down on the rink and keep a fire going for us to warm our toes and fingers at. And watching us, you know, hey, your nose is white, go rub some snow on it. We grew up in an atmosphere of tolerance and love.
Were children very special in Fairbanks because there were few and because
yes.
you were on the wilderness?
Yes, and because there were so many unattached men who didn't have families, and they just sort of felt very warmly toward all the kids in town, you know. You meet them on the street, someone would give you a 50-cent piece and say, here, go get yourself some candy. We didn't have anything a little smaller than a quarter, you know. There were no dimes or nickels.
Worth nothing.
Worth nothing. They were called chicken feed, and the only place you could get chicken feed was at the post office or the signal car telegraph office. And I remember that later years, in the early 20s, Lavery and Bailey was a grocery store right on the corner of 2nd and Cushman, and Mr. Bailey was a Scottish gentleman. And some dude, that's a Wyoming term, a tourist lady, gave him some dimes and nickels to pay for something she'd bought, and he walked out in the middle of the street and threw him in the middle of the street.
No good.
Mm-hmm.
Don't bring your chicken feet in here.
That's right.
Goodness.
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting characteristic things about life in Fairbanks in those days. I think I sensed it even when I was quite young.
You write that it was just a conglomeration of bankers and gamblers and miners and ladies of the street and proper ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow the proper and the improper meshed. And
yes, apparently it didn't, nobody was very much perturbed about it, and if there was a fire in one of those cabins on the row, the proper ladies would be the first ones to give clothing or money, and vice versa. In an emergency, it was all one community.
And
the rest of the time, the proper ladies set the pattern for the main social life of the town, and they even had a woman's, for several years, they had a woman's civic club that was supposed to keep things going, education and other things that were part of the community life.
Women had a great deal to do because they did
yes.
the hard work of keeping the house going and
yes.
raising children on the frontier as
That's
well.
That's right, yes, but they were given that stature and that standing by all the men. There was no question of discrimination the way we hear so much about today.
Right.
Women were into everything. They ran the dress shops, and they ran the roadhouses, and they could enter any business they chose. Nobody said anything about it.
I think Alaska...
And it was quite an interesting community spirit.
I think Alaska has not forgotten that in some ways.
I think that's true. I think that still exists from especially things I've been hearing just since I came up here this time. I think there isn't that kind of a question that there is in some other places.
Well, it may be, but it's not entirely there. It has seemed to me since I've been here that if you have gumption, you can get where you want to go.
Right.
And because we're still way out here, away from everything else.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. I think it has an effect.
You mentioned the fires. Fires must have been just a horrifying experience.
Yeah, they were. Yes, because they nearly always happened when it was a cold spell, 30 or 40 below. That's when people were firing up, you know, burning more. And that was, they were more likely to be fires. And usually it was a hotel or a saloon or something like that that seemed to catch fire. And it was very, very serious. And I remember the one big fire that burned out part of the middle of Fairbanks. The Rust family lived next door to us, and Jesse Rust was an engineer at the power plant. And so whenever there was a fire siren, he just had to run and get there. And he was in charge of, they pumped the water out of the river, you see. And that pump would start as soon as there was a fire. And they'd go out with the fire department of the horses and all that, and the hoses. But the whole town would be listening to that thump of that pump. And once in a while, that pump would stop, and it was just as though your own heart stopped beating, something, because that was, you know, very crucial. And then it was up to Jesse Rust to get it going again.
It fixed something in the middle of an emergency.
Yes.
To keep the water going.
And now, the one big fire that I remember that I describe in the book is from the NC Company on 2nd, up, I think it's Barnett Street, they laid a little track out about 8th, 9th, or it would have been 10th, right next to near the schoolhouse was a great huge wood yard where they hauled in wood because the boilers were fueled with wood. And these big teams of wood would come in from way out in the country over to Birch Hill and I don't know where all. And when we had that one big fire, the pressure wasn't keeping up enough to keep abreast of the fire, and the order went out that in the warehouse behind the NC Company, they brought out all the slabs of bacon and threw them in the boiler to speed up the fire, burn that fat.
Tremendous.
Yes.
Tremendous. March 12th, 1914 was a major day for Fairbanks because the railroad
bill had passed Congress. Yes. Delegate Wickersham did one of the longest, I can't think, what is the word for the making a long speech in Congress and not giving up the filibuster.
Yes.
Something like 22 hours, I think, although I wouldn't swear to that. Some historian will have to check that. But, of course, we did have the Signal Corps. We did have telegraph, wireless, and, of course, the news came right away. And there was immediately this impromptu parade down Cushman and down the front street, I guess. Mm-hmm. And one person had found a coal scuttle carrying that, because the thing about the railroad was that the big thing was that the Healy River coal mines could be opened.
Be connected.
That's so right. That would be another source of energy which was badly needed.
No longer would Fairbanks have to chop wood.
Right.
For its steam.
Yes.
It could get its heat and that electricity
both
from the coal.
And there had a man named Gobrock who was quite a musician, and he had a band he'd organized. And, of course, they were leading the parade with music and, oh, yes, great excitement.
And what this meant was that Fairbanks would be connected not only with Healy but with Anchorage and with Seward, and that meant with the rest of the world.
Oh, yes.
Because it connected.
Yes, that was the great big thing. And that was the thing that Mr. Wickersham had worked long and hard for, and finally
it happened. It also heralded the end of an era, which was the use of the Valdez Trail by horse-drawn sleighs for every kind of freight and mail.
True.
The major connection with the rest of the world.
Yes. Of course, now we have the automobile, and that trail is a big highway. But at that time, it probably was hardly used for a while.
By horse-drawn sleighs and sleds.
Yes.
And in 1918, you took the last trip out.
It was the last trip of the NC Company. They were giving up the business because the railroad was was coming, you see. And they knew that would be the end of their era, as especially for hauling freight and all that heavy. Yes.
This was a fairly momentous occasion, both for Fairbanks and for you. The last of the slaves meant a whole different way of living in Fairbanks, or at least of communicating with the world.
Yes, that's true.
But for you, you bundled up on top of a 14-foot snowboat and took off south. Can you describe some of this trip for us?
Well, in the middle of the winter, when the trail was a good, hard, snowy highway, they had these big thoroughbrace, they called them sleighs, and the passengers in seats in the back with charcoal burners at their feet to keep their feet warm and wolfskin robes over them. But in the early spring, when it was about to be the last trip and the trail was going to pieces, you see, we had to travel at night when things were frozen, and that was the last chance for the last trip over the trail. And that was not in any big thoroughbrace. It was what they called a double-ender, and it was a sleigh that was both the same on both ends and about 4 feet wide, and then had one seat tacked on in the rear. And I think we did have a wolfskin robe. I don't remember anything about charcoal. Well, we didn't need it, but it was
May
by that time. Yeah, breakup time, and it was warm, you know.
It was about 14 foot long and curved up at both ends so you could
move
it either way,
yes,
right?
Well, that's
you got,
right.
You got
yeah,
stuck,
it could
you
be
could
used
turn it
either
around.
Way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A team could have been hitched on either end, I expect.
And you?
And we went out to Salcher Roadhouse, was a nice roadhouse run by this dapper little German fellow, George Hiller, and his wife, who had just been brought from Germany very recently, and I just wondered about how she was adjusting to everything, but she was very busy in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing I guess I remember, the next stop was at Delta, and the roadhouse was run by a young Englishman, and he was a little bewildered about this one female appeared on the scene, and but the old barn men who were stationed there knew just what to do, you know.
But between Salcha and Delta, you had to cross a river.
Oh, we had to cross the Tanana.
Rapidly melting.
Yes, right. I did just what Roy Reinerson told me to do. Climb up on top of the load and hang onto the ropes, because the load in front of the seat was all the baggage, you see, and strapped into a tarpaulin and tied down. So I sat on, and he was on the driver's seat up in front.
You gripped the ropes holding the tarpaulin like you were on a bucking horse and went across the Tanana.
Yeah. The last few feet, the horses were out of their depth, and they had to swim a few strokes, but they knew what they were about, and up on the bank we went.
And you went.
And then just beyond there, before nightfall, we were at Delta.
Down at Delta.
The roadhouse. And these three, four fellows, and it was their last time. You see, they were all having to seek new occupations and new adventures, and they were discussing that. It gave me a little bit of an early day look into the lives of those men. Most of them had worked as teamsters there for years, and they didn't really want to leave Alaska, but of course the First World War was going on,
mm-hmm.
and some of them were planning on, and they did go out and join the forces in outfits that were using horses. Cavalry.
You mentioned both during this part of your story and later in talking about sourdoughs, people who've been a long time, and usually a long time working with the land, the horses or the mines. Or
yes.
That they talk about themselves being spoiled for anywhere else. Alaska's taken them and it won't let them go.
I think that's what they felt.
Do you have any sense of, I know people living in 1988 in Alaska who say the same thing. Alaska has caught me and won't let me go, but they can't necessarily say why. What is it about this state?
Well, there's a freedom of expression, I think. I think everybody feels free to be themselves and to express themselves in their as they feel, and it just makes an atmosphere of freedom in which to live every day. I don't know how else to explain it.
And even out
But I know it exists, and it's found in other places, too. I live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and there's a similar kind of a ethic or a feeling there. The land itself becomes very important to you. Yeah, well, I don't want to get off onto my favorite topic, wilderness, but I think that's all a part of what affects people who live in places like this.
Well, I hope you will, because I think that is also an important part of that thinking.
Well, I'll just say that Alaska is the, under the United States flag, is the last treasure of wilderness that we'll ever have. And I think we need to be very careful about what we do with it, because I think wilderness has some rights. And besides, even from selfish man's point of view, we don't know what other good things are hidden in the wilderness, such because we've already had penicillin and the cure for miliary tuberculosis and I don't know how many other illnesses made out of things that are found in the wilderness. We don't know what we're destroying when we destroy wilderness.
We're jumping way ahead in time here, but your husband, Olaus, was saved by a wilderness cure.
That's right.
Miliary tuberculosis.
Miliary.
Miliary, I'm sorry.
It means miliary comes from the word, the X-ray of a person with miliary tuberculosis looks like millet seed, specks in the lungs. And that's how it got its name, of miliary tuberculosis.
And the cure
was found because there's a bird in Africa called the honey guide, and there's a mammal there called the honey badger or rattel. The bird finds the mammal and guides him to the tree where there's a beehive. The mammal breaks open the hive because he wants the honey, but the bird wants the wax, and she has an enzyme in her stomach which dissolves the wax. And the reason that this form of tuberculosis was always fatal, up until about 3 years before my husband had it, was because that particular tuberculous bacillus is enclosed in a waxy capsule. So this new wonder drug, as they called it, ioniazid, pierces the waxy capsule and streptomycin kills the bacillus, and the person is completely cured.
And they wouldn't have found it except for the honey guide.
That's right. And the honey guide is in the wilderness of Africa. So I think we ought to be careful about what we destroy. And we're not treating our planet as well as we should be.
Let's return for a bit. I want to return to the wilderness, but let's
return
to the man you found in the wilderness.
Oh.
if you'll forgive me. When you came home from Reed College, 2 years later, your friend Jess introduced you to his friend, who was a young wildlife biologist.
Yes. Jess came by to say hello. He'd heard I had just arrived. And my family had moved down closer in town at that time, lived at 4th and Wickersham, 3rd and Wickersham. And he stopped by and he said, I got a new pal I want you to meet. His name's Murray and he works for the Biological Survey. And I said, Biological Survey, what's that? Well, after a while I found out. Later on, his wife Clara told me that Jess had met Olaus, he came home that evening to her and said, today I met the man Marty ought to marry.
Oh.
Yeah, he had it all fixed for me, you know. I was out at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, but he was...
He had it fixed.
And he had it fixed.
You didn't know for certain you wanted to marry this man for a couple of years.
No, that's right.
You took some time getting to know each other.
Took a year and a half or so, yes.
And in the meantime, he was out...
Well, he was out among the caribou most of the time, yes. And anyway, what's the best idea Jesse Rust ever had? And then because of our friendship, of course, then it had always, I guess they had talked about they'd like to have one big trip together, he and Jess. And also they were able to get a leave of absence from the NC company, or just to go with us on this Old Crow River trip, and that's how that happened.
That's when you had your 10-month-old son with you.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
And this is no easy trip.
No, it wasn't an easy trip because of the mosquitoes. Everything had to be tuned to the fact that we were living in the worst mosquito place in the world, I think.
No bug spray. No.
Well, we had Buhack, and we had other, you know, citronella was the only thing then. But we had a mosquito-proof tent, and we also had a little mosquito netting tent that we had in the middle of the motorboat, so the baby was always protected.
The baby was in a little box.
Yes, right, a packing box that said Ball brand rubber boots on it.
And there he bounced and stared through the netting at the river. And
that's right. The baby was perfectly happy. The only time the baby was uncomfortable was when we stopped at Rampart House on the Porcupine at the Mounted Police Station. And the Mounted Police were we were the first boat up the Porcupine River. And they were so glad to see us that he insisted on using his brand of powdered milk for the baby's meal there, and I didn't agree with him very well. When we came back down out of the Old Crow, the missionary at Old Crow Village was being very sweet and kind to us, and he gave the baby a piece of hardtack to chew on, and that didn't go down very well. But all the time he was up in the wilderness, he was perfectly okay. Yes.
He almost got, well, I can't say he almost got lost down the river. He went out of your sight in a harrowing moment at one point.
Yes, yes.
You've been trying to, now...
He was in the motorboat with Jess, but Jess had to drop down, and we didn't have the proper purchase. We had to let go of the ropes.
You were pulling the boat up the river.
Up through the rapids. Just that one place. And after you get through there, you're all right. It's a meandering, sluggish stream all the way up to its head. You finally get into clear water way at the head of the river.
But you and Mr. Murray would go pull your rope up, wrap it around the tree ahead of you, and then pull backwards to help your friend Jess as he pulled the boat up, right?
Something like that. No, we didn't have it around a tree. We were just hanging on to it, the rope, our main strength, just to give him enough extra. But the second time we tried it, it worked all right. Jess had a different angle on it. I don't remember, but we got up there through there all right.
And the baby had no more wild rides?
No. Well, he had a wild ride coming back down through that canyon at the end of the summer. And that was sort of, a kind of a dragon in the back of my head all the time we were up there, is the fact that we, by that time, had lost the crankshaft, lost the power, and I didn't know how we were... There was that canyon to get down through.
Which you had pulled and pulled up, but which would take you by main force down.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was big rapids for just a short distance. But that worked out all right.
Your dragon went back to sleep.
That was a great relief.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This was the second trip with your husband, Mr. Murray, and of course your friend Jess and baby Martin, but your honeymoon was a pretty remarkable trip also by dog team for the most part.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You left your birthday to be married?
Yes. And then we... from Anvik, we went upriver one day and were left off at Nulato, and we waited there for the Teddy H, the little sternwheel steamer, to come down the Koyukuk River to Nulato, and then we went up on it to Alatna. And we were trying to get up to Bettles, and the water was too low and all sorts of episodes, but we finally did get to Bettles, and we stayed there a month in a cabin, waiting for freeze-up, and the dogs had been shipped up earlier, so they were there to greet us. And that's where in Nulato, we first met Otto Geist, too. And that was a great friendship. I was talking the whole long story about that this morning at the museum. Yeah, it was a wonderful friendship.
While you were on your honeymoon, and, of course, meeting Otto Geist was a part of this adventure, your husband was collecting specimens, both very large and very small, to record what the wildlife in Alaska was like.
That's right. He was primarily on a study of the whole life history of the caribou, but he was also collecting other specimens for the National Museum. And while we were going upriver on the Teddy H, it was just wonderful. The boat would stop to wood up or for some other reason, and we'd go ashore right away and hike around and kill a couple of rabbits for the kitchen, for the galley, and he would maybe find some, shoot a bird or a small, some mammal that he was part of the, that he wanted for the collection. And then out on the deck of the ship, he would be skinning and preparing these specimens. And all the crew, some Kobuk Eskimo, some Koyukuk Indians, and Otto, who was the second engineer on the would be watching him. I mean, they were just fascinated with all this.
As he skinned out a caribou and emptied out the cranium and
Well, he
skull.
Didn't know. We didn't have any. We weren't collecting caribou on the riverboat. This was animals like a mink or a marten or a bird. I don't remember. I remember one mink that he didn't get skinned right away, and it was in the stateroom, and I found little doo-doo things crawling up my arm and gave a great shriek, and he said, "Oh, that doesn't matter. They won't stay on a human being, so they'll leave you." And
yes, but when, dear?
Yeah. Everything was taken very calmly. I had to learn that it was very seldom there was any great emergency.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had some trials and certainly a very different kind of life even than you might have expected growing up in Fairbanks.
I suppose it was I had some preparation because, well, I had had a dog. I had had Major. Mm-hmm. And then I had known other people who had dog teams, and they used to take us for rides. So, and Fairbanks was on the edge of wilderness in those days, so it wasn't altogether a shock as it might have been if he had happened to marry a girl from Arizona or New Mexico or something.
Who might not have liked life on the trail.
Right. The Smithsonian Institution has been sending parties of people on tours, and for, I think, about 8 years, they've been bringing a group to Jackson Hole to ski and to do various. And they have asked me each time to meet them at whatever hotel they're staying in or resort and give them a talk on Alaska. I have a slideshow. Mm-hmm. And one time I was doing it, and before I got started, a young woman in the group raised her hand and said, "Is it true you had a dog team honeymoon?" I said, "Yes." Then I wondered what kind of a mental image she must have of a dog team honeymoon.
Right. Well, you did go racing through the Arctic night with your dog team ahead of you, and your husband running alongside, and you running along the back.
That's right. Right. Yes.
Many, many miles at a time.
Yes.
When you left Alaska, you went to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, to continue his studies?
We went to Washington, D.C. that winter for him to turn in his reports, and then by the next, and then by the next spring, he found out that he was going to be being sent to the Old Crow River on that expedition, so that was the next thing.
With Martin.
And after that, we stopped off in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to see his brother, his half-brother Adolph, who was in graduate work there. And the authorities there told him that they had an extra fellowship hanging around that wasn't being used, so he went on to Washington and got a leave of absence for 7 months from the Fish and Wildlife, or Biological Survey, as it then was called, and did a year of graduate work in Michigan. And he went back at various times later to take his language exam, and his dissertation was his report on the caribou, and that was accepted. But he never had time enough to stay on the campus long enough to meet their residence requirements. Mm. So his old alma mater, Pacific University out in Oregon, as he said, made an honest man of him by giving him an honorary Doctor of Science degree.
So he finally became Dr. Murray.
Yes, and people were already calling him Doctor, and that bothered him because but when he got the honorary one, that was all right, I guess.
It sounds like that integrity of which you speak.
Yes. All a scientist has is his integrity, and I wish they could all think about that these days.
A large sign up above everyone's desk. Your husband and you worked for the biological science in Jackson Hole as well until...
Oh, yes, because he had studied caribou, he was sent to Jackson Hole in 1927 to make a complete life history study of the Jackson Hole elk herd, which is an elk herd of about 15,000 elk. That's about what the summer habitat can support.
Huge number.
And they thought the elk were starving, but Olus discovered that they were dying of a disease. And when they were able to do something about that, I don't want to go into all the details, but that took care of that problem. And the elk herd has been quite flourishing ever since. But in the meantime, they had established an elk refuge right on the edge of the little town of Jackson, and it has extended now up the valley, so it's a large area. And the elk come down there in the winter, and they let the hay stand so that they can get their own feed as long as possible, and then they feed them alfalfa pellets after that. Hmm. But the elk know where they're going and what's... They used to be clear out into the desert before white man's civilization came, and they just kept being pushed back farther into the mountains. And then when the snow begins to go in April, they start north and go up into the Teton Wilderness and Bridger-Teton National Forest and up toward Yellowstone. And that's where we spent 8 or 9 summers when our children were growing up and Lois was still working on the elk study. We would establish a camp and be out all summer.
And when he left the Biological Survey, or Fish and Game, is that when
Bureau of Biological Survey was what it was called, and now it's called Fish and Wildlife
Fish
Service.
Fish and Wildlife.
Yes, it's the same agency. And then he received an offer to be executive director of the Wilderness Society, and by that time, I at least felt, I guess even more than he did, but that the survey didn't have any research projects available right then that were commensurate with his experience or talents, and that bothered me a lot. Mm-hmm. So the Wilderness Society offer came as just a marvelous thing, but he said no thanks, he couldn't live in the city. Their office was in Washington, D.C. 3 days later they called and said, how about taking the job half-time and half-pay and stay in Wyoming?
Half-time and half-pay.
So that's what we did.
And the Wilderness...
But he was free then to do... And Howard Zonizer ran the Washington office, and they made a wonderful team. And things worked out very well.
And what kind of projects occupied as the...
Well, looking all over every place that needed to be protected as a wilderness. And there were lots of them. Mm-hmm. And there was the big battle over Echo Park Dam. And then there was always something, trying to save what wilderness had left.
In the 50s, you returned to... Look at what we think of as ANWR, the Arctic National Refuge.
Yes. In 1950 or 51, Olis and Sigurd Olson from Minnesota and Dr. Gates of the Geological Survey made a trip up into the Arctic by plane, but the weather turned bad and they couldn't stay up there very long. That was his first look at the North Slope. He and his brother Adolf, years before, when in the caribou study, had made a complete circuit all around the both ends of the Brooks Range and all the valleys in between. So he was already familiar with a good part of that country. And we had been up in the Koyukuk on our trip, and then we had been in the Old Crow, but in between there was the Porcupine and Sheenjik and that area that nobody seemed to know much about. So that's where we went in 1956, and we had Bryna Kessel with us and George Schaller and Bob Creer, who was from Colorado and was someone that had been part of our family for a long time, mm-hmm. and was a biology professor later on. And we had a perfectly wonderful time that summer on the Sheenjik. And we had lots of pictures, and Olis showed his slideshow about that in Secretary of the Interior Fred Seaton's office when we got back. And I think it was another year, I don't remember how much later, that Secretary Seaton designated the Arctic Wildlife Range, as it was called then. And I think that was in 1960. Mm-hmm. It was a great day. But then that much more has been added to it under the Alaska Lands Act, except that somehow in that act, the little phrase got in that this section... 1002 area, it was called, which is the main calving grounds of the porcupine herd, was still, quote, for further study. And that's the thing we're concerned about now.
That's where it remains now.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you to respond to something? This is from the preface of your book, and it seems to, well, it struck me fairly profoundly when I read it, and I would like your thoughts about it in 1988, if I can. So this is the passage. What, after all, are the most precious things in life? Here in Alaska, people still count as much today as in the 20s. I would love to think the world will survive its obsession with machines and see a day when people respect one another all over the world. It seems as clear as a shaft of the aurora that this is our only hope. My prayer is that Alaska will not lose the heart-nourishing friendliness of her youth, that her people will always care for one another, her towns remain friendly and not completely ruled by the dollar, and her great wild places will remain great and wild and free, where wolf and caribou, wolverine and grizzly bear, and all the Arctic blossoms may live on in the delicate balance which supported them long before impetuous man appeared in the north. This is the great gift Alaska can give to the harassed world.
Well, I'll try to answer that without getting too emotional. I still feel exactly that way, but I also still have hope, because some recent things have given me hope. I deal with young people a great deal where I live in Jackson Hole. There's a field science school there, Teton Science School, and they bring the youngsters over to spend some time with me. There are now, instead of one conservation organization in Alaska, there are 42, I think. And I feel that the people themselves are going to have to take some responsibility for what happens to their environment, and that they are beginning to do so. Maybe I'm an optimist because I'm a coward. I don't know. But I have hope that people will see the value of saving some of the land as it was before. Yes, impetuous man.
I don't understand that reference. Maybe I'm an optimist because I'm a coward. You have been exceedingly brave in your life.
No, I mean that maybe I'm a coward, though I don't face the facts. That some people might say the facts were that technocracy was going to take over everything and the wilderness would be disregarded and be developed and have roads in it and be ruined. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by...
And your optimism says no?
My optimism says no. The people will... Even if people can never be in a wilderness or see a wilderness, I think that they need to know it's there. And aside from all that, from my own personal experience in a wilderness, there are things in the wilderness that, as I mentioned before, we don't know yet what's hidden there that might be a benefit to man, like the honey guide.
Whether it can benefit man or benefit
or
itself.
Not. Right. Yeah. Yes.
Margaret Meary, this has been a most pleasurable hour, and I thank you for spending it with me. You've been listening, ladies and gentlemen, to Margaret Meary and her story of Two in the Far North, her story of her life and her life with Olaus Meary, her husband. And this is Sunday at Noon. Thank you for joining us. I hope you'll join us again next week. Funds for the production of Sunday at Noon were provided by the KUAC Public Affairs Programming Fund. Its contributors include Westmark Fairbanks. Thanks to my executive producer, Carla Tanella, also my engineer today. I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. Good day.